the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, April 11th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, City Aims to Add Firefighters Through Vote. Issue will go before South Sioux City voters this summer. As South Sioux City's population grows and the number of calls for emergency assistance climbs, city officials say the number of full-time firefighters the city employs needs to increase too. Voters will be asked this summer to approve a means to do that without increasing taxes. In a July 9th special election, city residents will vote on whether to relocate a portion of existing sales tax revenue now used for streets and infrastructure to the fire department. If approved, the fire department would receive approximately $330,000 annually, enough to pay and equip 3 firefighters, increasing the full-time force to 12. The measure would not increase the sales tax. We've got a great fire department, but don't have the money to have it properly staffed, Mayor Rod Koch said. Our goal is to not raise taxes, but you need firefighters, and the question is how do you get them? We would like to be staffed the way the chief wants to be staffed. The department currently has 9 paid full-time firefighters and is supplemented with volunteers. Fire Chief Doug Koopman said increasing to a minimum of 15 full-time firefighters would improve safety both for the community and firefighters. We're below standards to staff response to calls, said Koopman, who was hired in August. It's impacting the city greatly with the kind of service they get and impacts the safety of firefighters. The fire department currently staffs 3 full-time firefighters who all are either EMTs or paramedics on each of its 3 shifts. Koopman said ideally, 4 staff members should respond to each medical call, but South Sioux City usually has 2 or 3, and volunteers are often paged to fill in if they can, especially if a second call comes in while staff are responding to an earlier call. Koopman said 84% of calls are for medical reasons, and the call volume has increased by 10% since 2016 and continues to rise. In fire responses, National Fire Protection Association's standard calls for the first engine staffed with 4 firefighters to arrive within 4 minutes. To meet that number, South Sioux City must again put out a call to volunteers and other towns with which it has mutual aid agreements. At current staffing levels, South Sioux City firefighters attacking fires inside a building are often unable to leave a 2-person safety backup team outside. Adding firefighters would enable safety teams to be available for backup. If the sales tax measure passes, Koopman said that he could add 3 firefighters within weeks. The city also is applying for a grant from the Federal Emergency Management Agency that would pay for the salaries of an additional 3 firefighters for 3 years, bringing the department, if the sales tax relocation is approved, up to 15 full-time firefighters, and giving the city council a 3-year cushion to fit permanent funding for the positions into the city's budget. The city won't receive word if the grant application is successful for another year. If the city can add another 6 firefighters, it would continue the department's growth. South Sioux City's fire department was a 100% volunteer service until 2008, when 2 paid firefighters were hired to work 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. In 2016, the city hired its first full-time fire chief and 3 more firefighters. Another 5 were added in 2018 to bring the department to its current staffing level. To meet the standard of employing 1.7 firefighters per 1,000 people, South Sioux City would need to get a staff of 24 to 26. With Sioux City's ration currently at 0.6, Koopman said he'd take the 6 to get to 15 firefighters now, then continue to search for ways to add more. I'm always going to be asking, he said. The fire department currently has an operating budget of $1.8 million, with personnel making up the majority of that at $1.3 million. Adding 3 firefighters to that obviously would have tax implications for South Sioux City taxpayers. The budget is real tight. It would have amounted to a pretty big property tax increase, and we didn't want to do that, Cox said. When searching for ways to add more firefighters, City Clerk Finance Director Nancy Walsh suggested the sales tax relocation, an option that wouldn't result in the tax increase. "We just wanted to find a way to fund more full-time firefighters without raising property taxes," Walsh said. "We think this is a double solution, a doable solution, without raising sales or property taxes." Walsh said grants and state funding for streets and infrastructure projects would offset the sales tax revenue shift to the fire department. Koopman said that approaching voters to approve the sales tax relocation is a big ask, but it beats the alternative. "If this doesn't go, then the next step is raising taxes." Now, let's move on to the article. Nebraska lawmakers seek to solidify taxpayer-funded school choice before voters can decide it. Nebraska lawmakers are on track to pass a bill that would circumvent voters who could repeal a new law that funds private tuition with taxpayer money. The bill from Omaha Senator Luann Lehan, the author of last year's Opportunity Scholarships Act, advanced late Wednesday to a final round of debate, just a day after advancing from the first round of debate. It would change the way private school scholarships enacted last year are funded. The law passed last year by Nebraska's officially nonpartisan legislature did not appropriate taxpayer dollars directly into private school tuition. Instead, it allowed businesses and individuals to donate as much as $100,000 per year of their own state income tax to nonprofit organizations that award private school tuition scholarships. Estates and trusts could donate as much as $1 million a year. That dollar-for-dollar tax credit is money that would otherwise go to the state's general fund revenue fund. The law triggered an immediate pushback from public school advocates who blasted the measure as a school voucher scheme that would hurt enrollment and therefore funding for public schools and would allow taxpayer dollars to go to private schools that are allowed under religious tenets to discriminate against LGBTQ+ students. Those critics organized a petition drive to ask voters to repeal the law, and the drive collected far more signatures than needed to get the question on the November ballot. Acknowledging that voters might reject the new law, Lehan, a Republican, is now pushing a bill that would directly fund the private school scholarships from state coffers, thereby rendering moot any vote on a repeal of last year's law. The move drew renewed protests from opponents. Jenny Benson, president of the state's largest teachers' union and a leader of the petition initiative, called Leon's new bill a slap in the face to the 117,415 Nebraskans who signed the successful referendum petition to have voters decide the issue on the November ballot. Some lawmakers said that Lehan's new bill violates the Nebraska Constitution, which explicitly forbids the appropriation of public funds to non-public schools. Lehan countered that direct funding is allowed under a 1984 Nebraska Supreme Court ruling that allowed state funds to be used for scholarships at either public or private colleges. "The voters deserve an opportunity to be heard on this," Omaha Senator John Kavanaugh, a Democrat, said Tuesday during debate. "I disagree with the idea that we're going to interject ourselves between the petition process and the voters because they have the opportunity to be heard, but before they have the opportunity to be heard." Wednesday night's debate went much the way Tuesday's had, with proponents of the bill saying that their intent was to give students whose parents might not otherwise be able to afford it a choice to go to a private school if their public school is failing them. Opponents maintained that voters should get the right to decide if they want public dollars to be reserved for public schools. "Let's not do tricks and try and repeal bills once a referendum comes through," said Senator Wendy DeBoer, a Democrat, said last Wednesday night. "Let's let the people of Nebraska decide." Lehan's effort to change the bill has not been without struggle. She drastically lowered the amount allocated in last year's measure, using tax credit, which allotted $25 million this year, and in 2025, and up to $100 million annually thereafter, to cover such donations. She dropped that amount to $10 million a year with no escalation in the future in an effort to secure more votes. She got just enough votes to end a filibuster and advance the bill both Tuesday and Wednesday. It is likely to get enough votes to get through a final round of debate and pass before the end of the session's last day on April 18th. Now let's move on to an Iowa article. $900,000 plan to feed Iowa kids after $29 million offer axed. More than 3 months after turning down $29 million in federal funding for low-income families to spend on food and for their school-aged children in the summer, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds announced Wednesday a $900,000 grant program with similar goals. In December, Reynolds announced the state would not participate in the federal summer EBT program, which provides low-income families with $40 per month in benefits during a three-month period. That program started during the COVID-19 pandemic emergency and is now being made permanent. It was designed to provide free meals in the summer months to students from low-income families who receive free or reduced-price meals during the school year. States were given the option of remaining in the program. Iowa was among 17 states, nearly all with Republican governors, that declined. Reynolds, at the time, said that she believed the program was not sustainable and did not promote nutrition. The new state grant program is being funded by federal pandemic relief funds. It is designed to create additional summer meal sites that will serve more children in currently underserved areas across the state. The governor's office said in a news release, providing young Iowans with access to free, nutritious meals in their communities during the summer months has always been a priority, Reynolds said in a statement. With the Summer Meal Program Expansion Grant, we will expand these well-established programs across our state to ensure Iowa's youth have meals that are healthy and use local community farms and vendors when possible. The number of eligible applicants and their proposals will determine the number and amount of grants awarded across the state, the governor's office said. The grants will help school districts and other qualified organizations expand participation in two current federal summer child nutrition programs, the Summer Food Service Program and the Seamless Summer Option. Those programs are administered by the Iowa Department of Education in partnership with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Qualifying schools can participate in either federal program, and private nonprofit organizations, community and faith-based organizations, higher education institutions, and local government agencies will be able to participate in the Summer Food Service Program, the governor's office said. New meal sites must be located in an area where at least 50% of the children are eligible for free or reduced-price meals. The meals can be served at schools, churches, parks, libraries, and other public spaces, according to the governor's office. Luke Elzinga, board chair of the Iowa Hunger Coalition, said the daily average participation at a summer meal site in Iowa in 2023 was 21,557, which is less than 10% of the more than 245,000 Iowa children who would have received the $40 per month from the summer EBT that Reynolds rejected. While we certainly welcome the new grant program to expand summer meal sites, we also recognize that barriers will remain for families to access those sites. Summer EBT is meant to complement, not replace, summer feeding sites, Elzinga said in a statement. We truly hope this grant program increases access to nutritious food for low-income kids during the summer. But the fact remains that our governor chose to deny $29 million in federal funds that would go directly to low-income Iowa families with children who face additional financial struggles during the summer months when our kids are out of school, the statement continued. Under the new state grant program, priority will be given to applicants seeking to establish a new meal site and to schools or organizations that did not participate in the federal programs last year or in a county with two or fewer meal sites. Schools and organizations can apply for reimbursement funding for up to $10,000 for the first new site and $5,000 for each additional site. Up to a total of $20,000 for current program sponsors and $30,000 for new sponsors. Through partnerships with community-based providers and schools, the Summer Meal Program Expansion Grant will build upon family-focused solutions to support child nutrition and well-being in the summer. Iowa Department of Education driver Mackenzie Snow said in a statement, "The Iowa Department of Education remains committed to supporting students with healthy meals and food options as it supports communities in growing the impact of existing child nutrition programs. State House Democrats continued Wednesday to express their disappointment that Reynolds declined the larger federal program. While I appreciate the governor finally doing something for hungry children in our state, that the competitive grant program announced today amounts to crumbs for Iowa kids, Senator Sarah Trone Garriott, a Democrat from West Des Moines, said in a statement. Governor Reynolds could have accepted $29 million in federal food assistance that would have reached 240,000 children in every corner of the state. The $900,000 state program she announced today is tiny by comparison and forces Iowa communities to compete for a sliver of the much smaller pie. And it's not enough to meet the real needs facing our state, and it doesn't make up for her decision to let Iowa kids go hungry. Trone Garriott and Elzinga said the new state program does not account for some barriers to low-income families getting help from their food assistance programs, like a lack of transportation to get to the meal sites, or who live in areas without meal sites. While summer feeding programs have their place, they are not accessible to all Iowa families, Trone Garriott said. Families must bring their children to and from the site every day, which is impossible for most working families. There are many Iowa school districts and entire counties that don't even have a feeding site. As a result, these programs assisted less than 20,000 children last year. The governor could have expanded these programs and participated in the summer EBT program, but instead, she put politics before the health and well-being of our kids. Applications for the new state program are being accepted at iowagrants.gov through May 7th. Now, let's move on to the article. Sioux City School District's tax levy to drop again in 2024-2025 school year. The Sioux City Community School District property tax levy for next school year will fall slightly compared to the current levy. The school board on Monday unanimously approved a total budget of around $228 million for the budget this year, that begins July 1st. The levy for fiscal 2024-25 was lowered to $12.38 per $1,000 of assessed value, compared to the current levy of $12.43. This is the 16th time in 17 years that the district has lowered the levy, according to school officials. Despite the decrease in the tax levy, school board member Dan Greenwell noted total property tax collections will increase by around $1.6 million as a result of the increased assessment of property in the district. The district will have an estimated $197 million in general funds spending. This is the first year since the COVID-19 pandemic that the district will not have education and secondary school emergency relief funding. The certified budget of $197 million includes $663,082 of AEA support that could be impacted by the change in state legislation and does not include any changes due to increased teacher-based salary. During the budget process, the district estimated that the state would provide student supplemental aid increase of 3%. State lawmakers instead approved a 2.5% increase in general fund spending for public districts. Patty Blankenship, the district's chief financial officer, said the difference is a loss of approximately $575,000 to the district's coffers. As a result, the district officials had to make adjustment to the budget. Some Sioux City residents expressed confusion regarding a letter sent to them about the tax levies during the public hearing last month. Last year, Governor Kim Reynolds signed a bill that required counties to send letters to all residents regarding public hearings for proposed tax levies. During a public hearing, Craig Brubaker asked the board about the tax levy and if it's another tax increase for residents to be concerned about. "I'm sick and tired of the federal government, right down to the local government, taking my tax dollars and spending it any way they choose. It's not fair and it's not right," Brubaker said. The article, House Built by Sioux City Career Academy Students, Up for Sale, Open House Offered This Month. The first house built by Sioux City Schools students is up for sale. In August, students were welcomed into the new Sioux City Career Academy construction trades facility located along Business Highway 75. More than 35 students spent the year building a house for Habitat for Humanity, as well as district-owned house. The goal was that over 2 years, students would build a 1,300 to 1,500 square foot house and learn introductory construction, HVAC, and electrical plumbing trades. The first year would deal with exterior work, and the second year would be interior work. Construction went faster than any district administration expected, and the house is almost ready to be sold. The district-owned home is 1,646 square foot, single-family, one-story ranch house with 3 bedrooms and 2 bathrooms on the main floor. The house also features an electric fireplace in the living room and quartz countertops in the Students built and installed every aspect of the house with help from instructors, local businesses, and trade unions. An open house will be held from 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. on April 25th for potential buyers. Interested buyers will be asked to submit formal bids to purchase the home, according to the district news release. A detailed buyer's guide is available to the Sioux City Career Academy. The winning bid will be selected based on the proposed purchase price, financial capability of the buyer, and adherence to the terms and conditions of the sale, according to the news release. Bids must be submitted by May 9th and include a variety of information, including the buyer's full name, full address, contact information, including phone number and email, proposed purchase price, method of payment, proof of funding, or financing, including bank statement or proof of bank loan. Bids should be submitted via email to Eric Kilburn, the principal of the Sioux City Career Academy, at kilbure@livesiouxcityschools.com. Here's a small, brief article. It says, Sioux City receives a Tree City USA designation. The Arbor Day Foundation has named South Sioux City a 2023 Tree City USA. South Sioux City received the Tree City USA designation by meeting the program's 4 requirements, maintaining a tree board or department, having a tree care ordinance, dedicating an annual forestry budget of at least $2 per capita, and hosting an Arbor Day observance and proclamation. The community also received a Tree City USA Growth Award for demonstrating environmental improvement and an outstanding level of tree care. The trees being planted and cared for by South Sioux City are ensuring that generations to come will enjoy better quality of life. Additionally, participation in this program brings residents together and creates a sense of civic pride. Whether it's through volunteer engagement or public education, Dan Lambie, chief executive of the Arbor Day Foundation, said in a news release. The Tree City USA program is sponsored by the Arbor Day Foundation in partnership with the U.S. Forest Service and the National Association of State Foresters. Another smaller article. March runoff into Missouri River below average. Though runoff into the Missouri River above Sioux City was below average in March, the annual runoff forecast has been increased slightly. March runoff into the Upper River Basin was 1.8 million acre feet, 59% of average. Using current soil moisture conditions, mountain snowpack, and long-term precipitation and temperature outlooks, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers raised the annual runoff forecast from 17 MAF to 17.5 MAF, 68% of the average of the 25 MAF. While the forecast remains below average, the basin has shown some improvement in runoff conditions since the March forecast. Given the reach runoff and basin conditions, we expect runoff in April to remain below normal for all reaches, but this will depend on precipitation and temperatures, John Remus, the chief of Corps Missouri River Basin Water Management Division, said in a news release. Remus said an overall lack of snowpack in both the plains and the mountains has led to the below average annual forecast. Dry soil caused by drought in 60% of the basin has contributed to lower runoff totals. Mountain snowpack, which feeds the Upper River Basin when it melts, has been below average through the winter and spring, the Corps said. April 1st, snowpack ranged from 74 to 84% of average. About 95% of the total mountain snowfall has typically fallen by April 1st and usually peaks near April 17th. Water storage in the river's 6 reservoirs is at 54 MAF, below the flood control zone that starts at 56.1 MAF. Water releases from the Gavin Point Dam near Yankton, South Dakota, were increased to 30,000 cubic feet per second in March to provide flow support for downstream river navigation. Releases will be adjusted accordingly in response to precipitation, mountain snowpack melting, and other conditions, the Corps said. Now let's go on to the article. Conservatives pushing for winner-take-all election. By the time conservative activist Charlie Kirk took the stage, there was no doubt that it was Donald Trump who had led him to travel to Nebraska and pressure state lawmakers to adopt a winner-take-all system of awarding Electoral College votes. You see what's ahead of us, Kirk said Tuesday night at a rally before a crowd of about 500. Trump versus Biden is bigger than just an election. It is a civilizational survival question. Kirk joined the Nebraska Republican Party, currently led by Trump loyalists, to hold the rally Tuesday in an evangelical Christian church located in a southwest Omaha shopping center. While about 500 people packed the room in which Kirk spoke, about 400 more were in overflow rooms set up elsewhere in the church, said spokesman Andrew Colbert of The Turning Point, the pro-Trump organization that Kirk helped establish. Most of those attending roared approval every time Trump's name was mentioned. Michael Tiedemann, the 38-year-old newly elected chairman of the Sarpy County GOP, said the same momentum that saw Trump loyalists take over the state party in 2022 will drive the effort to move Nebraska to a winner-take-all system before the general election. The Democrat Party is pouring huge funds into our second congressional district because they can get one electoral vote, he said. Their target state is the state's atypical system of splitting its five presidential electoral votes. Two are statewide votes, but the other three are tied to the congressional districts and go whichever candidate wins the popular vote in that district. Maine is the only other state to split the electoral votes. The 48 other states award all of their electoral votes to whichever candidate wins statewide. It was probably well-intended, but this whole thing is just the goofiest thing I've ever seen, Kirk said of Nebraska's split system. Republican Trump could need every electoral vote he could get to defeat President Joe Biden in a rematch of the 2022 race. Kirk said rally stemmed from a map that he and the team that produces his podcast saw last week showing that if Biden were to win the Rust Belt swing states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, an electoral vote from Nebraska would give him the 270 electoral votes for re-election, even if Trump carries all of the other swing states. One of our team members came out and said, yeah, unless Nebraska just goes and fixes it, Kirk recounted. The issue gained national attention when Kirk urged his followers to call Republican Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen's office to urge the state to adopt a winner-take-all approach this year. 5 hours later, Pillen issued a statement urging the legislature to pass a bill currently stalled in committee. That would change Nebraska to a winner-take-all state. Shortly after that, Trump is posted on a social media platform, Truth Social, to praise Pillen for the urge to switch. Republicans, who have long dominated Nebraska politics, have sought unsuccessfully to return to the state winner-take-all since it was adopted more than 30 years ago in 1991. The sticking point this year has been a focus on property tax reduction, school funding, and a number of wedge issues. At the time Pillen called his last week to pass winner-take-all on bill, only a handful of days remained in the session, not enough time to pull the bill from committee and get it through three rounds of debate ahead of other priority bills. Now, Kirk and Nebraska Republicans want the governor to call a special session after the current session's last day on April 18th to pass a winner-take-all measure. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, April 11th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Let's finish up this article and then we'll turn to today's obituaries. Continuing the previous article about Nebraska politics, I had a very promising phone call with somebody in the governor's office today and they are committed to getting into a special session to get this to happen, Kirk said. While it's certainly within Pillen's purview to do so, it's not clear there are enough votes for a winner-take-all bill to pass in the unique one-chamber Nebraska legislature made up of 49 lawmakers. The body is officially nonpartisan, but lawmakers self-identify as Republican, Democrat, or Independent, and tend to vote along party lines. Republicans currently hold 33 of the legislature's body 49 seats, which is just enough to break a filibuster, as long as all 33 Republicans vote to end debate. But Omaha Senator Mike McDonnell, who switched parties last week from Democrat to Republican, told the Nebraska Examiner that he would not vote for a winner-take-all system. Pillen did not attend the rally, nor did any state lawmaker, as the legislature worked late Tuesday in the last days of this year's session. Still, Kirk and others, like Nebraska GOP Chairman Eric Underwood, urged the crowd attending the rally to call lawmakers daily and agree to take up and pass the measure ahead of the November election. If November 6th comes and we didn't do everything we can, we're going to lose this country, Underwood told the crowd. We're going to pass winner-take-all, and we're going to find a way to get it done. Now, let's move on to today's obituaries, starting with Lorna Vollmar. Lorna Vollmar, age 94, of Holstein, passed away on April 8th, 2024, at the Holstein Senior Living of Holstein. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, April 12th, 2023, at the St. Paul's Evangelical Lutheran Church of Holstein, with Pastor Del Olivier officiating. A burial will be at the Holstein Cemetery of Holstein. A visitation will be held on an hour prior to the funeral service starting at 9:30 a.m. The Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Holstein is in charge of the arrangements. Lorna Isabel Vollmar, born November 11, 1929, in rural Holstein, to Fred and Laura Meyer. She was baptized on December 8, 1929, and confirmed on April 2, 1944, at her beloved St. Paul's Evangelical Lutheran Church. She graduated from Holstein High School in 1948. Lorna was united in marriage to her high school sweetheart, Don, on September 24, 1951. They were blessed with two children, Cherie and Randy. Lorna was a member of the St. Paul Sewing Club, Ladies' Aid, Bible School, and Logos. She also volunteered for the Welcome Wagon. Lorna was a member of the Good Samaritan Auxiliary and was a Girl Scout leader. She enjoyed playing golf, tennis, and bridge, as well as gardening. She was an accomplished sewer and an excellent cook. Lorna was always available for people in need, and there was always there with a helping hand. She is survived by her daughter, Cherie and Steve Voss of Galva, Iowa, son Randy and Kathy Vollmar of Holstein, grandchildren Eric Voss of Holstein, Nathan Voss of Galva, Heather Wade White of Dallas, Texas, Darcy and Brock Bowling of Holstein, Emily Vollmar and James Dockstad of Sioux City, Melanie and Jared Nolting of Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Christina Vollmar and Jeremy Bomar of Ankeny, Iowa. Great-grandchildren Jared, Emma, Gavin, and Cameron Voss, Karis, Bria, Luke White, Graham, Nash, and Knox Bolin, Stella and Amelia Doxad, and Harper and Evelyn Nolting. She is also survived by her sister-in-law, Elaine Vollmar of Kansas City, Kansas, and her two daughters, Chris and Stacy. Vollmar, nieces Joy Schroeder Spokane of Washington, and Donna Schroeder of Las Vegas, Nevada. Lorna was preceded in death by her husband, Don, her parents, Fred and Laura Meyer, parents-in-law, Willard and Meta Vollmar, sisters, Inns Meyer and Irene Schroeder, brothers-in-law, Harold Schroeder and Dean Vollmar, and nephews Bob, Richard, and Stuart Schroeder, and niece Sharon Schroeder. Online condolences may be made at nicklasdenjensenfh.com. Ruby Marie Meyer Holstein. Ruby Marie Meyer Holstein, 88, of Hull, Iowa, died Monday, April 8, 2024, at Pleasant Acres Care Center in Hull. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, April 12th at Tabernacle Baptist Church in George, Iowa, with Pastor Brian Anderson officiating. Following a luncheon after the service, burial will be held at 2 p.m. on Memorial Park in Sioux City. Visitation with the family present will be held prior to the funeral service from 10 to 11 a.m. at the church. it was Ruby's request that memorials may be directed to Tabernacle Baptist Church. Porter Funeral Home of Rock Valley, Iowa, has been entrusted with the funeral arrangements. For Mrs. Hollison, condolences may be left for the family at www.porterfuneralhomes.com. Ruby Marie Meyer, daughter of Fred and Gladys Holt Meyer, was born in rural Webb, Iowa, on December 13, 1935. She graduated from Marathon High School, class of 1954. On April 19, 1955, Ruby married her high school sweetheart, Jack Hollison, at Marathon, Iowa. The couple had made their home in Alta, Iowa, from 1955 to 1965, then Sioux City, Iowa, from 1965 to 1992, and lastly their home in Hull, Iowa. Ruby and Jack were members of the Tabernacle Baptist Church in George, Iowa. Jack died in December 31, 2014. Ruby's life revolved around her faith, family, and friends. She carried on an intense correspondence ministry with all the above. Her love for others was constantly on display. Ruby is survived by her two sons, Don and Sonny Hollison of Colorado Springs, Colorado, and Paul and Charlene Hollison of Orange City, Iowa, daughter Carol and Kelly Bolsema of Ashton, Iowa, seven grandchildren and eight great-grandchildren. Ruby was preceded in death by her parents, Fred and Gladys, older brother Paul, and younger sister Mary. Now, let's move over to the sports section, starting with some basketball, with She Does It All. Stanley's all-around effort helped by Helen achieve success. At least for some, it's hard to identify Brooklyn Stanley's best quality on the basketball court. She does too many good things to pick one. And the thing that she does best can change from game to game, play to play, depending on what her team needs in any given situation. The Sioux City Journal's Large School Player of the Year, Stanley's malleability in the court separated her from her peers this season. A multi-sport athlete who also plays soccer and runs cross-country, she fell in love with basketball at a young age. "I've been playing basketball since I was probably 5 years old," Stanley said. "I've been playing with a lot of the same girls over the years and grew up watching my siblings play. I'd go with to watch my sister play AAU and watch the Helen games. That was a pretty cool experience. I remember watching my sisters play for Helen at the Pit, and I'd sit on the stage with all my friends. All I wanted was to be a player out there and have all the little kids there to watch me. That was something that made me really look forward to playing for Helen and really made me fall in love with the sport. It was more than just basketball." Stanley's hoops career ended as Helen's fifth most productive scorer with 1,182 career points. She also notched over 360 rebounds, more than 280 assists, and nearly 340 steals. A three-time All-Stater and three-time All-Missouri Athletic Conference selection, her four-year varsity career saw the Crusaders amass a 86-14 career record, including three straight trips to Class 4A state tournaments, semifinals, or further. She's just a really unselfish player who will do whatever it takes to win," said Bishop Helan, head coach of Darren Koolstra. "She took on a lot of the roles for us. On defense, she was at the top of our 1-3-1 zone, or if we went man-to-man, she was typically guarding one of the other team's best players. We asked a lot of her, and she played about 32 minutes a game. But she really took it upon herself to contribute in more ways than just scoring. She realized there were good players around her, and she could distribute a little more. She worked really hard to improve her passing." Stanley led the Crusaders in scoring as a sophomore and junior, but saw scoring help emerge this past season in both the form of freshman Melina Snoozy and junior Abby Lee, both All-Staters, along with the consistent contributions from senior Maddie Demke and junior Maddie LaFleur. With the scoring less of a priority, Stanley's basketball IQ kicked in, and she was among the team leaders in several categories on both offense and defense. I don't put much thought into what I need to do," Stanley said. "It just happens naturally. I try to be a very unselfish player on the floor and do whatever the team needs to win." This year's team was a lot different than last year's team. Last year's team was different than the one before it. People's roles change, and I think that adjusting to that worked well for me and the team. It was really important for us to play together as a team in order to be successful as a team. Demke and Stanley both averaged over 4.5 assists a game. Stanley finished third on the team in scoring average at 13.9 points per game on a 45.2% shooting from the field. Stanley led to the Missouri River Athletic Conference in total steals at 95 and steals per game at 3.8 this season. We had really good leadership on the team this year with Maddie and Brooklyn in the starting lineup, Koolstra said. They just continued to get better and expand their roles on the team and off the court. A Northwest Missouri State commit, Stanley has logged thousands of hours in gyms all over the Midwest, from practice to travel teams to helping the Crusaders or playing in senior all-star games. "We're really excited about getting her here," said Northwest Missouri State's women's basketball head coach Austin Meyer. "We saw her on the AAU circuit just as we hired Christ Guess as an assistant back when he was at Waukee and is in the Iowa Girls Basketball Hall of Fame. He was sitting at a court at one tournament and came up to me afterwards and said, 'You're going to love this kid.' We watched Brooklyn a few more times and loved how hard she plays. She never looks tired and was constantly high-fiving, slapping teammates on the back, whatever. You could tell she's a great teammate. There's a lot of intangibles that stick out with her, too. She's obviously very talented, too. She's a highly efficient kid who gets rebounds, steals, assists, whatever you need. We're big on getting high-character kids, and she definitely fits that. But she credits a lot of growth to time spent playing against her older sister, Caitlin, especially when the two saw opportunities to grow while others may not have been working on their game. A lot of my growth as a player came out of the COVID-19 pandemic," Stanley said. "A lot of places were shut down, so Caitlin and I would go to the gym together. It was just us. We'd work on drills and other things. And for all the wins Stanley has been a part of, there's one that sticks out that came when the sisters crafted their skills. My sister really helped me fall in love with the game," she said. "I'm a big family person, so to have her around and helping me has been special. As siblings, we're competitive, but we love to see each other be successful. However, those two aspects may not always be perfectly aligned. Caitlin and I would play a lot of one-on-one," Stanley said, "but I beat her one time, and I haven't let her hear the end of it. But there's always love there. It's not super aggressive competitiveness between us. Although the ultimate goal of a state championship escaped the Crusaders during Stanley's tenure, the trips to state and high-pressure games that came with a successful career made everything worthwhile. We had a lot of great accomplishments here," Stanley said. "It was really great. It was really special going to state. That's never guaranteed, but we worked hard to get there. Getting there was always our favorite week of the year. Despite the outcome and the emotions that come with that, it's still one of the best weeks because we had to get to spend so much time together at the hotel and do a lot of team bonding. Although to her, some of the off-court time produced some of the best memories, her on-court play will be remembered as some of the best among Crusaders to suit up for the program. She's just a complete basketball player," Koolstra said. "She'll take on anything and accept any role as long as it helps the team win. Those are the players you want. She does it all. It's getting harder these days to find a basketball player who can do it all." Now let's move on to what appears to be a track article with Sioux City Relays almost here again. Olsen Stadium hosts 59th running event. The 59th running of the Sioux City Relays made a return to Olsen Field this weekend when the games get underway Friday. Field events start at noon and running events begin at 3 p.m. with Delbert Christensen's women's 5K. Around 6:45, the Rich Vanderloo Middle School Relays take over the track, with the men's and women's 400-meter dash finals interrupting a plethora of boys and girls 400-meter relays around 7 p.m. Friday's races are capped off with the women's 10K at 8:10 p.m., followed by the men's competition. Saturday races get going at 8:15 a.m. with field events commencing at 9 a.m., with the state's events largely consumed by high school competitions. Shortly before 4 p.m. on Saturday, the Terry Hersum 400-meter relay will lead off against the session of the event. Will lead off the last session of the event. The closing session will also include the men's and women's 4x100 races, as well as the girls' and boys' high school 800-meter run, and the 4x400 relays for men's and women's, as well as high school boys and girls. Hall of Fame inductees will be honored at 2:10 p.m. on Saturday. Last season, Saturday was completely wiped out by inclement weather, something that the area's prep athletes hope doesn't happen again. The men's and women's competition will feature athletes from many colleges from Iowa, Nebraska, and the Dakotas. Mount Marty was among the most successful men's teams at the games last season. Mount Marty's Donovan Breckenridge, then a sophomore, beat teammate Dominic Archer in the men's 100-meter dash with a time of 10.7 seconds. Breckenridge was the runner-up to Ben Jeffries, who ran an unattached in the 200. Nathan Simmons, also of Mount Marty, won the men's 400 in 2023 with a time of 48.07 seconds, and Mount Marty's Cristianobel Gonzalez won the 10K with a time of 32 minutes and 5 seconds. While those efforts are on the higher end of what can be expected at the Sioux City Relays, a wide spectrum is on display with an eye on giving some of the spotlight to those who many compete for the men's and women's title in the future, but now be in the middle school competitions. The collegiate events include a number of schools from the Great Plains Athletic Conference, including area schools Morningside, the host, as well as Briarcliff, Dort, and Northwestern College. Other schools include Buena Vista, Augustana, and Wayne State. The middle school and high school competitions will feature student athletes from across Siouxland. Boys and girls from over 40 high schools are expected to be in attendance. Now let's go on to a women's NCAA championship article. It says, Women's NCAA championship outdraws men. The women's NCAA championship game drew a bigger television audience than the men's title game for the first time, with an average of 18.9 million viewers watching the undefeated South Carolina beat Iowa and superstar Caitlin Clark, according to the ratings released Tuesday. The Sunday's afternoon game on ABC and ESPN outdrew Monday's men's final between UConn and Purdue by 4 million. The Huskies' 75-60 victory averaged 14.82 million on TBS and TNT. The audience for the women's game, in which the Gamecocks won their fourth national title and denied Clark's Hawkeyes their first, peaked at 24.1 million during the final 15 minutes. You're seeing the growth in many places, attendance records, viewership, and social media engagement surrounding March Madness, UCLA coach Corey Close said. It was the second most watched non-Olympic women's sporting event on U.S. television, trailing only the 2015 Women's World Cup final between the United States and Japan, which averaged 25.4 million on Fox. That also was a Sunday and took place on prime time for the East Coast. The record for the most watched women's basketball game still belongs to the gold medal game of the 1996 Atlanta Olympics between the United States and Brazil, which averaged 19.5 million. South Carolina coach Don Staley played for that U.S. team. Nielsen's numbers included an estimate of the number of people who watched outside their homes, which wasn't measured before 2020. Due to cord cutting, the in-home audience has steadily declined annually. The audience for the national title was up to 90% over last year when Clark and Iowa fell to LSU. That also was the first time since 1995 that the championship was on network television. The audience was 289% bigger than the viewership for the Gamecocks title 2 years ago when they beat UConn on ESPN. I had not seen it much women's basketball before this year. I didn't make an appointment television this year. It was an appointment television, said former CBS sport president Neil Pilsen, who now runs the sports television consulting company. That's what happens when you see those numbers. There was a lot of people making notes to sit down and watch the games. During the Final Four, Clark said the audience growth was benefiting all of women's sports, not just basketball. I think you see it across the board, whether it's softball, gymnastics, volleyball, people want to watch. It's just what they're given. It's just when they're given the opportunity, the research and the facts show people love it, she said. Clark said, Clark and Iowa have the three biggest audiences for women's college basketball. The Hawkeyes' victory over UConn on Friday night averaged 14.2 million, and their April 1st victory over LSU in the Elite Eight drew 12.3 million. Iowa's six NCAA tournament games on ESPN and ABC averaged 10.7 million. However, as Clark heads to the WNBA, many wonder if the college game can continue to attract large audiences. Clark was the marquee player of March Madness, but there was an impressive group of freshmen headlined by Southern California's Juju Watkins, Notre Dame's Hannah Hildego, and Texas's Madison Booker. Watkins set the NCAA record for points by a freshman with 920. It also helped that the women's game got increased exposure during the regular season on network television. Most audiences during March Madness also turned in before Iowa's games. UConn's 80-73 win over Southern California in the Elite Eight on April 1st, which tipped off after Iowa's game, averaged 6.7 million. During the Sweet 16 on March 30th, LSU's victory over UCLA, which preceded the Iowa game, averaged 3.8 million. The championship game's return to network television has also benefited the women's game. UConn's victory over Tennessee in 1995 averaged 7.4 million on CBS. Despite ESPN's work raising the profile for the tournament since it acquired rights in 1996. The closest the network got to the number for the final was in 2002 when 5.68 million watched UConn beat Oklahoma. I think our game has been good for a long time, and I think people just missed the boat. Now we finally got that exposure and people have understood, wow, I haven't watched women's basketball for a long time. Now I missed something. I don't think they're going to want to miss anymore, Iowa coach Lisa Blutter said during the Final Four. Caitlin has certainly been a tremendous star for our game, but there are so many stars in our game. We're just going to latch onto that next one next year. Now let's finish off today with some times for when games will be played coming up here. Starting with Thursday, college basketball at 6:30 p.m. on ESPNU. Kentucky will be at Auburn. There's some college hockey at 4 p.m. on ESPN2. NCAA Frozen Four tournament, Denver versus Boston as semifinal, and that'll be at St. Paul, Minnesota. And 7:30 p.m. ESPN2 NCAA tournament, Michigan versus Boston College. That's a semifinal. For some golf today at 2 p.m., the PGA Tour on ESPN, and 7 p.m., ESPN, the PGA Tour as well, two different rounds. NBA basketball tonight at 6:30 p.m. on TNT, New York at Boston, and on True TV, New York at Boston as well. Looks like tomorrow there is some auto racing. FS1, there's NASCAR Craftsman at 3 p.m., and at 5 p.m. on FS1, NASCAR Xfinity Series, and 7:30 p.m., FS1, NASCAR Craftsman. College basketball tomorrow, 7 p.m., ESPNU, LSU at Tennessee, and some college softball, 6 p.m., Duke at Clemson. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, April 11th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.